From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on December 4th, just a month ago, on Taylor Glacier in Antarctica. A research team was working on extracting ice samples. That team includes members from the University of Rochester, and they'd run into some trouble. The large ice melter system used for collecting samples of ancient methane had a leak. That threatened to derail their progress that day, and you've got to use your time on a glacier wisely, because you never know when the next round of dangerous weather could shut things down for a while. Well, the team was able to find the source of the leak and replace the seal, and by the end of that day, the team had worked 20 hours. They produced a remarkable reward for their efforts, a core of ice containing air estimated to be 12,500 years old. It's mankind's personal record, frozen for us to study. That research team is home now, and today we hear from them in our monthly science roundtable. We're looking at the science of climate change, of warming. Specifically, this team on previous expeditions has documented a 30% increase in atmospheric nitrous oxide concentrations from 16,000 years ago to 10,000 years ago. So what makes nitrous oxide so important? What does it tell us about future warming in our planet? Here to help us understand in studio is Vas Petrenko, an assistant professor of earth and environmental sciences at the University of Rochester. And Vas, nice to see you again.
Thanks for having me on the show again.
Ben Meal is here. He's a PhD student at the University of Rochester who was, I thought you were scoffing at 35 mile an hour winds today in Rochester, but you said on Taylor Glacier, 35 miles an hour is pretty common?
Yeah, it's fairly common.
So this is not nothing today, in other words. This is something.
Average Antarctic conditions.
Average Antarctic conditions. On the phone with us is Professor Ed Brook of Oregon State University, someone who has had a lot of experience in this area and many expeditions himself. Professor Brook, thank you for taking the time.
You're welcome. It's great to be on.
Let me start with you, Professor Brook. When we look at nitrous oxide, we've been hearing plenty about methane, carbon dioxide, et cetera. Nitrous oxide, if we think of it at all, as laughing gas. But what's the value in this kind of study?
Yeah, that's right. We know nitrous oxide is laughing gas from the dentist's office. Nitrous oxide with methane and carbon dioxide are the three greenhouse gases that humans are changing in the modern atmosphere, causing global warming. And so we're quite interested in what controls its levels, and we can learn about that by looking at past changes, which is what we did on Taylor Glacier.
Okay, and so we're talking, Vas Petrenko, we're talking, in this case, 16,000 years ago to 10,000 years ago. What's significant about that time period?
So that time period includes the last deglaciation, the time when the Earth was transitioning from the cold glacial period to the present warm interglacial period. And that's really the last time in Earth history when the Earth went through a really large global warming. So there are some parallels that we can draw between the warming that we're seeing today and the warming that was seen between 16 and 10,000 years ago, and learn some lessons from that about what we might expect in the future.
Okay, and there's a lot of different areas we need to go here. For our listeners, if you've got questions about climate change, about what we're learning from this research and what it can tell us, you can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Vas, I want to follow up with one question just to get this out of the way, just because we have seen climate change and warming 16,000 to 10,000 years ago, obviously long before industrialization. It doesn't mean that we are just in another similar cycle, that this is just the same thing that we've seen over the epochs, over the thousands of years, right?
That's correct. It doesn't mean that what we're seeing now is just part of a natural cycle. What we're seeing now is definitely driven by human activity, and this has been confirmed time and again by dozens, really hundreds of scientific studies.
And primarily through, well, I don't say primarily through, partially through, from what I've seen, just looking at the sharp rise in carbon dioxide, for example, that we can look at thousands upon thousands of years, and then all of a sudden we see the outlier, and the outlier is us.
That's correct. If we look back at the record of the past atmosphere, which is available from the kinds of ice cores that we drill on our expeditions, we can actually go back 800,000 years in time. And we can see that there are natural variations in greenhouse gases like CO2 and methane, but the levels that we see now are completely unprecedented. CO2 now is higher by about 40% than it's ever been in the last 800,000 years, and methane is higher by about 2.5 times.
Okay, and so before I get back to Professor Brook from Oregon State University, again, Vas Petrenko and Ben Meal in studio, Professor Brook on the phone. Ben, when you're working on a glacier and extracting samples, I open the hour with sort of the story from your blog, which if you haven't followed along the Ice Core blog, the University of Rochester and the Ice Core blog, it's fun to follow because they give you great updates and great pictures. You've got to extract samples in difficult conditions. Take us through, there's no typical day, but take us through a day on Taylor Glacier, if you could.
Okay, Evan. So the first thing you do is you wake up in your tent, and usually there is screaming wind keeping you awake, because mind you, we sleep outside in tents out there. We do what we can to stay warm. And then once you get dressed, we all eat breakfast and then just pretty much get to work.
You learn to sleep, by the way, in the cold. You have to.
Yeah. Usually you're just so tired from all the work, since it's very physically demanding, that after a few days you get into a rhythm of it, and it's fairly easy to fall asleep.
Okay. And then when you get out in the field, I guess you hope that the weather is cooperative enough to work, right?
Correct. There are certainly some times when the weather is just, it's either too windy or, you know, there's too much blowing snow to really be able to get work done, and that time we have to stop. But, you know, we're only out there for a limited period of time that, you know, our flights and all the logistics have been planned around, so we need to maximize our time as much as we can.
And you're using drills to get down how far? We're talking about samples, in this case with nitrous oxide, 16,000 to 10,000 years ago. Voss has talked about samples that go back, 800,000 years? How far down are we talking about to extract those kind of samples of ice?
Well, Taylor Glacier is actually a fairly unique site in that there is old ice available fairly close to the surface. Normally, these samples that go back, you know, hundreds of thousands of years can be up to 2 miles beneath the surface level. However, due to the conditions of Taylor Glacier, we actually only go about 10 to 20 meters deep to get the samples that we need.
And Professor Brook, I imagine if you've got trouble with the drill, there's probably good corner stores on Taylor Glacier that offer replacement parts for ice drills. Is that right?
Not exactly, no. The corner store is McMurdo Station, where there are people who can help us out sometimes. But that's a helicopter flight away, and if the weather's bad, the helicopters don't fly. Normally, we're on our own to try to bring enough spare parts and expertise to fix everything. And we do pretty well.
You've done remarkably well. And so when it comes to, again, these gases, so nitrous oxide goes up 30% from roughly that 6,000 year period, 16,000 years ago to 10,000 years ago, toward the end of the last ice age. I hope I'm saying that correctly. And what does that help us understand now? What's the practical application, Professor?
Right. You do have it correct. What we're interested in this kind of study, and often in many of the studies of the past atmosphere, is really how climate and the greenhouse gases are linked together. As Vas pointed out, that the modern situation is different. We're pumping these gases actively into the atmosphere. And what we want to know is how quickly and how much the climate system will respond. And it's a very complicated system. One of the things we're after is how much extra change there might be in these gases as the climate warms. If you take CO2, for example, as you warm up the climate, the soils will give off CO2, which gives some extra CO2, which gives some more warming, and we call that a positive feedback. With our study of nitrous oxide, we wanted to understand what the nature of those changes are. And when we see the climate warm as the nitrous oxide is rising, and we're able to tell that some of the N2O nitrous oxide comes from the ocean and some of it comes from the land. And so we get a better handle on how we can predict those kinds of changes in the future.
It sounds, Professor, like a similar feedback loop, nitrous oxide compared to, say, carbon dioxide. Yes?
Yes, I think that's right. All of the greenhouse gases have feedback loops, and what we need to understand is how big they are and how sensitive they are as we warm up the climate in the future.
All right. And so, Voss, when it comes to these gases, we've had discussions on this program about carbon dioxide, what it is, what it does. Nitrous oxide, let's talk a little bit more about what it does and why it is potentially a concern if we're going to see a lot more of it.
So there are two things that make nitrous oxide of interest if you're studying climate and trying to understand climate change in the Earth's system. First, it's a greenhouse gas, so it actively traps infrared radiation that's escaping the Earth. Through that, it affects the balance of the energy fluxes that are the energy that is coming in from the sun versus the radiative energy that is escaping the Earth. And that's how all the greenhouse gases, including CO2 and methane, work. So that's one of the reasons why we want to understand more about nitrous oxide. The other reason is that nitrous oxide, it sticks around in the atmosphere for quite a while. Its lifetime in the atmosphere is about 130 years. And the way it gets destroyed in the atmosphere is when it reaches up into the upper parts of the atmosphere called the stratosphere. In the stratosphere, nitrous oxide can get destroyed by ultraviolet radiation, as well as by reaction with very reactive oxygen atoms that are generated in the stratosphere. Through that, you form other forms of nitrogen oxides, which then can help to destroy ozone in the stratosphere. By increasing the amount of nitrous oxide in the stratosphere, we can actually speed up the ozone destruction cycle.
Okay. And Ben, when you're looking, you know, when you're doing work on Taylor Glacier, for example, how do you know, this is such an ignorant question, and apologies from the non-scientist in the room, but how do you know if a sample that you're taking is 16,000 or 15,000 or 10,000 years old?
That's actually a good question. It's something that we have to be concerned with constantly. We're able to measure the concentration of the gases inside of the air bubbles in the field. We bring with us a full-fledged laboratory to do these kind of measurements. And by comparing the air bubbles' content with other recorded ice cores that have been very well dated, we can, you know, get an age estimate of how old our samples are that we're collecting.
Okay. And so I'm starting to see some very interesting questions coming in from our audience online. And again, if you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Our monthly science roundtable is looking at the science of climate change and the recent work by this team that's made numerous expeditions to, among other places, Taylor Glacier in Antarctica, where they have studied, again, among other things, nitrous oxide. That team includes Voss Petrenko, an assistant professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Rochester, Ben Meal, a PhD student at the University of Rochester, and on the line with us is Professor Edward Brook of Oregon State University. Voss, on your most recent trip, which just concluded a few weeks ago, when did you get back?
So I returned from Antarctica on December 13th, but I actually left halfway through our field season. The rest of the field team is still in Antarctica. Most of them have now left the glacier. They're at McMurdo Station. There's still a couple of people on the glacier, though.
And you were studying specifically what this time around?
So this time around, there were a number of things that the team was interested in. On the Rochester side, we were really interested in getting a record of the carbon-14 content of past atmospheric methane, because this helps us to understand, again, how methane was changing in response to past climate change and what the different methane sources were doing. There are a number of natural sources of methane. These respond to climate change in different ways, and we're interested in understanding how these sources are going to behave with the current warming and the future warming, and how large these positive feedback loops that we talked about could be for methane in this case.
One of our listeners wants to know about the context of truly long-term climate change. So let me read the comment, and I'll start with Professor Brook, and we'll let the panel respond here. Going back far, he writes, this is from Jake, he writes, quote, going back far enough, it's known that prehistoric CO2 levels were 2+ times higher than even the most nightmarish global warming predictions hint at. Granted, that was natural CO2 sources, where we know that the current forces by large are man-made. That being said, what can we learn from these previous highs that might apply to our future understanding of how life adapts during these warmer, high CO2 levels and the carbon cycle in general? Could your guests add any comment about the truly prehistoric climate? 800,000 years seems like a long time, but it's a drop in the bucket compared to the age of the Earth. The fossil record easily goes back several hundred million years. Can we really understand true global climate change when we look at such a small overall window? Professor Brook?
Sure. That's a very good question. And the questioner is correct. The ice core record only goes back 800,000 years. We'd like to find older ice. We're actively looking for it. We haven't found it yet. Ice cores give us the best view of the past atmosphere. There are ways to tell, for example, what CO2 was like going back further in time. And so if you can go back many tens of millions of years into the geological record, find times when we think CO2 was higher than it is today and maybe even higher than it will be 100 years from now, what we know from those times is that it was quite a bit warmer than it is today. And so we actually can tell how sensitive the climate system is by looking at those kinds of data. And I think the main thing we learn is that carbon dioxide, as it goes up, causes the Earth's climate to warm. Now, how it's a little harder to tell something about how we will adapt to the future, because natural changes are generally slow, and the human-caused changes are going to be very fast and imposed on a human system. And so we can learn some things about how ecosystems might change, but in terms of how it will impact humans, the past record doesn't help us that much.
Vas, what do you think?
Well, I agree with that it was a really good question. Going back in time, as Ed mentioned, we can use other information from geologic records to estimate the past CO2. The estimates are more uncertain, but if you get several types of records all agreeing that CO2 was considerably higher than today, then you can be pretty confident that CO2 really was higher than today. And as Ed mentioned, yes, all of these instances when we know CO2 was higher than today, we see indications of climate being much warmer than today. In terms of adaptation, again, I would echo Ed's point that our best understanding of the geologic record suggests that the rate of CO2 rise and the rate of release of carbon into the atmosphere that we're seeing today is completely unprecedented. We just, even going back many, many millions of years, we don't have any evidence for anything happening this fast. On the timescale of a few thousand years, we've seen events where an amount of carbon that was released into the atmosphere was comparable to what we could release over the next century or a couple of centuries. And that caused a very large global warming, both on land and in the oceans, and large-scale climate change and ecosystem changes. But again, those kind of changes were much, much slower than what we're experiencing today.
Okay, so to be clear again, what we expect and the pace we're seeing over a century or less required even millions of years ago, thousands of years. It's happening at a speed that this planet has never seen.
That's correct. As far as we can tell from the geologic records, the speed right now is an order of magnitude, 10 times greater than what we've seen in the past, at least.
Professor Brook, you mentioned that the goal would be to find ice samples that go back beyond 800,000 years, which, again, for us is hard to even consider as being young, I guess, relatively, but you're going to try to do that. Is there any sense that you have exhausted the search, or you've looked in what you think are the best places? Where do you go next?
Yeah, we is the international ice coring community, think there's a pretty good chance that there is older ice in Antarctica. We would go to East Antarctica because that's the slowest moving ice sheet, so it has most likely the place to find old ice. And we don't exactly know where to go. We need to do geophysical surveys to sort of find the spots that might be moving very, very slowly at the base of the ice sheet. And so there's active research to do that. I think there's a pretty good chance. The goal is to get to one 8.5 million years. Ice older than that's going to be really hard to find. But I hopefully over the next 10 years you'll hear about older ice core drilling.
Is there, I don't want to say a gap. It's not a gap in the record, but what are we... Let me go around the room and go around the panel and ask that question. I'll start with a PhD student. What are the areas that need, again, we've been talking about trying to find older ice samples and a larger record even beyond a million years. What to you are the biggest needs in understanding climate and change and the impact historically that will help us understand what's going to happen generationally now going forward? What would you like to see?
The most important thing that the ice core community is really looking at as far as finding records of past climate change is really when we can see these large jumps, these large changes in climate, when the Earth went through either substantial warming or cooling period during the glacial cycles. And the best evidence for that is the past deglaciation, 10 to 16,000 years ago, as you had introduced. So there's lots of focus on studying that time period, because essentially as you look further back in time, the uncertainty increases. We're less certain about the age of the ice as it gets older and older, and there's more complications with getting that ice. It's more difficult. So I would say that the past deglaciation is really the time period that we need to look at, because it's the last time the Earth saw a major shift.
Vas?
That's a really excellent question that you asked, Evan. I think there are a number of things that we would hope to understand in order to predict future climate change better. One of these is certainly the response of the carbon cycle to warming. And, of course, this goes both ways, how the climate responds to increased CO2, as well as how does the land-ocean system respond in terms of the carbon cycle and affecting the level of CO2 in the atmosphere. One thing that I think would be very, very valuable to improve our estimates of future warming is to improve the estimates of past CO2 a few million years back in time. So there was a globally warm period between about 5 and 3 million years ago, called the early Pliocene period. When there was relatively little ice, the Arctic was quite warm, the sea level was considerably higher, and we know from a variety of geologic records that CO2 was probably comparable to today's, maybe even a little bit lower, but the uncertainty bars on those CO2 estimates are a little too high to get really, really... high quality information about, how does the whole climate system respond to CO2 level of that magnitude. So that's something that, if I had to name one thing, that's probably something that I would name.
And Professor Brook?
Well, you've heard some really great answers. There are obviously a lot of things of great interest here. One other one I would add is that there are previous warm periods in the ice core record, like the warm period we're in today. A few of them were probably a little bit warmer than our modern climate, and they provide an opportunity to understand how the climate system operates when it's warm. And those are time periods that aren't really well covered in all of the ice core records. And so those, what we call past or previous interglacial periods, are another good target for more research.
If you're waiting on the phone, we're going to get to the phones coming up after this 60-second break. We're talking about the science of climate change with our monthly science roundtable with a panel that has extensive experience not only drilling for ice but in some of the really rough conditions on this planet. Taylor Glacier in Antarctica, and their research has indicated, recent findings suggest 16,000 to 10,000 years ago, the end of the last ice age, saw a 30% rise in nitrous oxide. Carlo writes in to say, we've heard so much about carbon dioxide, sometimes methane. Why is this the first time hearing about nitrous oxide? Well, we'll try to get Carlo's question answered after the break, and your phone calls straight ahead right here on member-supported public radio. Coming up in our second hour, we sit down with Sister Grace Miller of the House of Mercy talking about Sanctuary Village in Rochester. It was the homeless encampment that the city of Rochester took apart on December 20th. The city says it was a health hazard filled with hypodermic needles, and they want a long-term solution for the homeless. The homeless have called it an outrage. What happens next? Join us next hour.
Everyone has a favorite author, actor, musician, or comedian. At All Things Considered, we don't just bring you the news of the day. We introduce you to the coolest people you thought you knew and learn what really makes them tick. What you hear might just surprise you. I'm Robert Siegel. Join us every afternoon for All Things Considered from NPR News. Conversations that connect.
This afternoon at 4.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back. And Vas Petrenko, what do you eat on a glacier? What's
food?
I was hoping the answer was going to be food. I mean, is it food over? Are there warmish meals? I mean, you cook every meal?
Yeah. So we eat quite well, and we need it when we're there. We have a large enough team that we employ a camp manager whose full-time task is to essentially operate the camp, which includes preparation of dinner and organizing the kitchen, and as well as resupplying the camp and coordinating things like helicopter flights, coordinating fuel resupplies, food resupplies, anything else that we might need. And it's one thing that's really different about our diet is that we eat a lot. Once we get to the glacier, our bodies realize, oh, wait a second, this is really cold, and I have no place to get out of the cold at all. So the first few days when I'm on the glacier personally, I'm generally a little bit uncomfortable, just cold. And then after the first few days, the body's metabolism kind of ramps up, and my body starts demanding more food as well. So I eat about a time and a half more when I'm on the glacier than I eat when I'm in Rochester. Another thing is that we don't get a lot of fresh foods, things like fresh vegetables or fruit, because they're just hard to come by.
I imagine. But interesting look at life on a glacier and the work that these teams have been doing. Again, recently returned from a trip there. And the Ice Core blog is absolutely worth following online. Great pictures and great descriptions for those of us who want to follow along with the work they're doing. I'll throw a link on Twitter later today. That's what I'll do. So if you want to follow at Evan Dawson on Twitter, I'll throw a link to the Ice Core blog so you can check it out. This on the phone is Paul in Rochester. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, good afternoon. Excuse me. A few years ago, not too many long ago, there was a major race with Russia in digging through the ice. They were to be the first ones to hit a certain depth with hopes of finding all types of interesting and strange worlds underneath. By chance, because I don't remember any the outcome of that, do you know what Russia found when they drilled through, and did they find what they were hoping for?
I'm guessing that Ed knows the most of any of us about this one. Ed, do you want to try answering this one?
Yeah, sure. I'll take a stab at that. The Russians are experts at ice core drilling and have been doing it for a long time, mostly at a place called Vostok Station, which is a very inaccessible location in East Antarctica. And they were really the first to do deep drilling in collaboration with Americans and French scientists. Underneath the Vostok Station site, there's a lake, a subglacial lake, one of the first ones that was recognized. And there has been a race of sorts to penetrate subglacial lakes. The Russians have actually penetrated Lake Vostok. So there's liquid water underneath the ice sheet. And what they did was they drilled through and let the water from the lake flow up into the hole and freeze. And then they were going to go back and drill into that lake water. And the idea is that there might be an isolated ecosystem underneath the Antarctic ice sheet. I do not know what the results of that investigation actually are. Other people are drilling into subglacial lakes as well, and it's really early days in that science.
Paul, does that answer your question?
Yes, I thank you, and you have a great day.
All right, Paul, thanks for the call. Let's get John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Happy New Year to you all.
And you too.
Your panel. I got a question in regards to, I'm one of the skeptics out there on climate change being primarily man-made. I look at, and I've done some reading. I'm not a scientist, but I've listened to other experts in the field, some meteorologists that are nationally known that also don't believe man-made climate change is...
Well, a meteorologist is not a paleoclimatologist, but go ahead.
But the point is, they're scientists in their own right, and they've observed weather patterns and have done studies on it. But the, my point is, what about the sun? What about volcanoes, naturally emitted methane that comes out of from the earth, that type of thing, which is not man-made. It's something that really can't be stopped. And the issue of Antarctica, I understand that in Antarctica there's a buildup of ice versus the Arctic, which ice is receding. What are your comments on those points?
Thank you, John, for the call. And let me start with Professor Brook. I know you've heard these questions for a long, long time. Professor, go ahead.
Yeah, there are a couple of different questions there. All of them good, I would say. You know, one thing about skepticism is that it's a cornerstone of science, and so being skeptical is important. As far as the question about volcanoes and the sun, that kind of gets back to an earlier discussion about climate cycles. You know, is modern global warming just a cycle? It's a fantastic question. It's such a good question that we've been trying to answer it and answering it for many decades now. There's a lot of science on this. And the answer is that those cycles in volcanoes and cycles in the sun do exist, but they're actually going the wrong direction to explain the warming of the last 50 years. The warming of the last 50 years is clearly due to humans. And I think that's pretty settled science. It's not that those things don't have any impact, but they're just not going in the right direction. Greenhouse gases from volcanoes are not a significant source to the atmosphere compared to human activities, so sort of an additional point. And then the thing about the caller mentioned sea ice, and it's true there have been changes in Antarctic sea ice, but we have to look at sort of the long-term, you know, sort of decade-long record. Short-term changes in lots of climate variables are apparent and part of the longer-term trends, but I don't think the Antarctic sea ice expansion has much to say about the long-term climate future over the next 100 years.
To Professor Brooks' point again, John asked about volcanoes in terms of emissions, just in terms of carbon dioxide. Volcanoes do contribute an annual amount that is just fractional compared to industrialization. Fair to say,
Voss? Correct.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. But again, I think to Professor Brooks' point, the fair questions and hopefully answered well there. This is James in Canandaigua. Go ahead, James.
Hey, I'm not much on the scientific end of it, but I was with the Air Squadron. They used to fly Hercules aircraft down to the ice and land the aircraft on skis.
You landed the aircraft on skis? Interesting, yeah. Go ahead, Professor.
Can you tell us what years you flew?
I was with the squadron, I think, in like 70, 71. Or no, it would have been later than that. Probably early 80s.
That's great, James. And, you know, it's still the Hercules aircraft that support our operations, both in Antarctica and in Greenland, where we do some additional work on ice cores.
Right. Another point is that I got 2 weeks leave, flew up to Australia, and spent all my, you know, or some of my saved up money, and had a really nice couple of weeks in the middle of that stay.
James, thank you for the call. And you can't really position yourself in too many places to fly up to Australia. But really, again, Voss, that was 40 plus years ago, but sort of still a parallel today to how you transport and what you rely on, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's still the Air National Guard that supports the majority of the Antarctic operations for the U.S. Antarctic Program, as well as all of the Greenland operations. And we ourselves often fly through Australia and sometimes through New Zealand as well to get to Antarctica.
Let me go to Keith in Pittsburgh. Go ahead, Keith.
Okay, no, I just want to preface this that I'm just a normal guy with, I got a couple letters after my name, but they have nothing to do with science. To help that one caller out who is somewhat skeptical, I'll try to put it in as simple terms, and maybe the smarter people there can correct me. One of the laws of physics states you can't create matter, you can only change it. So if you burn a billion tons of coal, let's say, you're going to create slightly less than a billion tons of carbon dioxide that necessarily didn't exist until you burned it, because the carbon was sequestered in the ground and not really affecting anything. Okay, so now you got a billion tons or less of carbon dioxide in the air. The only way you're going to get rid of it is through photosynthesis. But that only is a temporary remedy, because when the whatever is alive that's using it dies and starts to rot, it puts the carbon dioxide back into the air. So if you just take carbon dioxide into an environment and keep increasing and increasing it, you will get warmer, correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Carbon dioxide sticks around for a very long time, and as you pointed out, one of the ways you can remove carbon dioxide is via photosynthesis. So you actually can remove some fraction of the CO2 that we've put into the atmosphere by expanding the biosphere, essentially, you know, expanding the amount of forests that are growing and the amount of greenery that is on the Earth's surface. And that is going on today, and that's actually responsible for a large I should put it as discount that we get on our CO2 emissions. Not all of the CO2 that we emit from burning fossil fuels ends up in the atmosphere. It's actually only about 40%. The rest is being taken up by the biosphere that is expanding, as well as by the ocean.
The other comment too, when you go to natural gas, you're heavier on the hydrogen side than on the carbon side. And the byproduct of burning hydrogen is water. Which leads me to my third thing. That's why hydrogen would be the perfect fuel, because you burn hydrogen and essentially the byproduct is water. And that's why Germany is pushing hydrogen as a fuel development. And we're lagging behind in that.
Keith, thanks for the call. And let me ask the panel. I'll start here with Ben and work our way around then. Keith's talking about... Again, this is a group of researchers. Their job is to do the research on, is the term paleoclimatology? We're talking about thousands upon thousands of years of climate studying, ice samples, et cetera. If you're just joining us, our panelists on this monthly science roundtable have studied it on Taylor Glacier in Antarctica. They've looked at, again, thousands of years worth of ice and of air samples. And so we're trying to understand what's happened over time. Their job is not to enact policy, but they're people like all of us, and the question is, what excites you the most when it comes to alternative energy? Now, Keith is saying if we could only get to hydrogen. He talked about Germany, but Germany is leading the way in many ways with solar. So, Ben Meal, a PhD student at the University of Rochester, what excites you most about alternative energy systems?
Solar, actually, is the one that excites me the most, because, you know, the sun is essentially, from our point of view, a limitless source of energy. It's putting out a very... You know, it's the largest energy source, you know, for millions of miles, right? And if we could develop a technology to better acquire solar and make it more available, I think that is one of the keys to being able to, restructure our energy economy.
Vas Petrenko?
I don't think I have a clear favorite among the options of renewables. I'm certainly excited about renewable energy. I think that this is a direction that we should be moving. Because I see the climate change that is happening. I know that it's going to continue to happen, and the impacts on our civilization are going to continue getting stronger and more difficult to deal with. So I think it's a direction we have to move in. But solar is very promising. I think the costs of solar energy have been coming down, so it's really becoming quite competitive in the energy market. But I think wind is quite important in some regions where wind is consistent. I think also biofuels can fill in some gaps in places and times when neither solar or wind are very available.
Professor Ed Brook from Oregon State University?
Yeah, it's a great question. Rather than picking one winner, I think it's important for us to recognize that solving the problem of future warming basically is keeping greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. And there's been a lot of good sort of large-scale analysis of that problem, which leads to the conclusion that we need all of the methods we can muster to make it work. We need wind power, we need solar energy, we need improvements in efficiency, which might involve using hydrogen as a fuel, and probably 13 or 14 or 15 other things, all working together to keep greenhouse gas levels down. And there, I think there are a lot of exciting developments in all of these technologies. I was just reading about advanced weather forecasting that helps people decide how to balance wind power versus other sources of power. And we have a lot of potential, even with what we can do now, to decrease emissions.
Well, here's what concerns me. We have been talking on this program about your research in this case that looks at air samples from 16,000 to 10,000 years ago. We know you've worked on samples that go back, and you can access ice cores that have air samples from 800,000 years ago. And yet every time we talk about what we're going to do regarding energy and the environment, it's as if one generation ahead, you know, 25 to 50 years, even 100 years, is just beyond people's comprehension. And I have no idea. I'm going to speak out of school because I have no idea population trends. In 1,000 years, if human beings are still on this planet, we've got, what, 7.5 billion people today? The trends indicate we're going to have a lot more than 7.5 billion people. I don't know where they're all going to go, and I don't know where the power is going to be derived from, and I don't know what the coastal areas are going to look like or where they will be. But I don't know. Professor Brook, I get a little concerned that sometimes we talk about 100 years as if no one could ever get their brains around it, and that's a... You want to talk about a blip. That's a blip. We should really be thinking about generations upon generations, I would think.
I mean, this is a great point. A lot of projections of future climate end at 2100. And, you know, part of that is just because of the limitations of computer power for climate models and things like that. But that's not that far away anymore. And so we really do need to be thinking more like 2200, 2300, you know, the path we're on right now in burning fossil fuels isn't a good one for those future times. Like you said, time doesn't stop at 2100. And I think it makes sense to take that longer view, and people are doing it, but humans have a problem thinking that far ahead.
I would say that encapsulates it well. Well, let me get back to Carlo's question. He wrote in and said that a listener named Carlo writes, quote, "We hear about carbon dioxide, sometimes methane. Why is this the first time I'm hearing about nitrous oxide in regards to climate change?" It's an interesting question. I'll start with Professor Brook and kind of come around the room because, again, the research that your team has focused on looked at nitrous oxide. Why do we hear less about that?
Well, I mean, we have been studying nitrous oxide for a while. This certainly isn't the first study of...
Yeah, you all don't hear less about it. The rest of us do in the media. It's really our fault.
Well, just to give my, you know, other colleagues around the world a lot of credit. It's a harder gas to measure, and its greenhouse effect is not as large as that of CO2. And so it hasn't been the thing we've gone after first. The connection to ozone is becoming important, in part because other things that destroy ozone are actually decreasing in the atmosphere, so nitrous oxide is becoming more important. So as we get better at making measurements, we start to understand more about different aspects of the atmosphere.
Ben, where is our public conversation on warming lacking? Carlo's indicating he's listening to this program, and he says, I haven't even heard about nitrous oxide. Where is it lacking to you? When you talk to your friends who are not in the scientific field, where are the biggest gaps?
I mean, there's gaps everywhere as far as the conversation about, you know, climate change and warming. But, I mean, I think, you know, we all just need to be focused on what the science is really telling us. Because I think, you know, there's a lot of discussion and disagreement about things in the scientific community that have been very well proven. And so I think we need to communicate, you know, the facts, the basics again, about you know, that, yes, climate change is certainly happening, and, you know, communicate that better and to more people.
And as cumbersome as that can be, and but still important, Voss, where are the biggest gaps to you?
That's a great question. You know, I think in conversations with, if we're talking about conversations with friends and relatives and other people who are not actively researching this question, I think the biggest issue from my perspective is that there's just a tremendous amount of misinformation out there, you know, on the web, on television. It's, you know, and a lot of this misinformation is to the effect that there is this really active debate, you know, whether or not the current global warming is human caused or whether it's part of the natural cycle, as well as what other things could be causing it. But what most people, what a lot of people, I should rather say, don't realize is that by now the science on most of these questions really is settled, and that, you know, 97% of scientists agree that that global warming that we're seeing today is human-caused, and that you really have to listen to the scientists, and that if you see a debate on a scientific issue of climate change, say on television or you hear it on the radio, between somebody who is a skeptic and somebody, you know, who does research on climate change, that you have to realize that the real debates on the science actually happen in this really dense peer-reviewed scientific literature, and that's where these discussions take place. It's not that someone can win a debate and prove a point in a television debate.
Professor Brook, help us put a bow on this discussion regarding the science of climate change, and particularly this question of nitrous oxide. And again, for those listeners just joining us, the finding that 16,000 to 10,000 years ago, roughly the winding down of the last ice age, saw a surge in nitrous oxide by 30%. Is that what you would have expected, Professor Brook? I mean, is that a surprise to you? What does that say to you?
No, it wasn't a surprise to us. Everything we've seen in the records of past climate say that the greenhouse gases are very directly associated with warmer climate. So, and the question now that we're after is why? What are the mechanisms in the land surface and in the ocean that cause those changes as the Earth warms? Because those are the types of things we should expect that will also change in the future. We weren't surprised, but very happy to be able to document exactly how it happened.
Ben Meal, PhD student at the University of Rochester, when are you going back to a glacier?
Good question. The next expedition we have planned for the University of Rochester, at least, is in May. This coming May, we'll be going to Greenland this time. So not a glacier, but the center of the ice sheet itself, and it's still similar conditions.
Voss, you going to that one?
Yes, I am.
Back to Greenland? You've been to Greenland how many times?
This will be something like the 14th.
And how many times have you been to Taylor Glacier in Antarctica?
Taylor Glacier, I've been there four times now.
Okay. Yeah. And Professor Brook from Oregon State University, your next expedition will be when?
Well, I'm an older guy, so it depends on whether these guys will let me come back, I think.
But, you're welcome back anytime, Ed.
Probably next winter back to Antarctica.
Last question for you, Professor. Have these expeditions changed for you over the years? I mean, do you still get the same sort of scientific zeal and fire for these trips?
Oh, I love going. In addition to the, you know, all of the science, these locations are really stunningly beautiful. That's just an added treat to be able to go to the coldest places in the world and hang out in these wonderful landscapes that hopefully will stick around for a while.
Professor Ed Brook from Oregon State University, thanks for spending the hour with us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And Voss and Ben, great to talk to you guys again as well. I imagine when you are on a glacier together, it necessitates camaraderie and sort of bond. You agree with that, Ben?
Absolutely. I mean, when you're spending 6-7 weeks with the same, 8 to 10 people with no way out at all, you need to cooperate. You need to be able to, operate in an effective manner.
Is spooning scientifically proven to help get some sleep time, Voss?
Spooning?
We're talking about snuggling, sir. That's what I think at night. At least, at the very least, I would think that the night times are cold, but at least you get through the worst of it.
I don't know.
That's for your,
we haven't tried this on the
glacier. That's for your next study. That's for your next study. It's always so fascinating to talk to you, and Voss Petrenko has been on this program before. Great stuff as well, and thank you for sharing your expertise and helping distill it for us. Voss, thank you.
Thanks very much for having us.
And Ben Meal, good luck in Greenland in May. Thank you for taking the time, and great first visit to Connections.
Thanks a bunch.
This is our Science Roundtable, our monthly Science Roundtable, a great group. Thank you for listening. Short break. We're coming back talking a very different subject, our second hour. We're talking Sanctuary Village and the question of the homeless in Rochester next.